Esther 3, verses 4 through 6. Esther 3, verses 4 through 6. Now it came to pass, when they spake daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matter would stand. For he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. Esther, the book of Esther, pulls back the veil on the mind of inspiration, I think, in some very interesting ways. Mordecai, think of it, for his part in uncovering the plot against the king, he has his deed recorded, but it's not yet rewarded. As we turn the page on the whole affair respecting Bigthan and Teresh, it might seem that what would happen next would be the record of Mordecai's reward. That would be the next thing you would expect in this story. And yet, in an odd way, we have quite the contrast. Haman is presented here as being elevated. And that not only at the expense of Mordecai, but as we're going to see, at the expense of all of the Jews. It almost seems then that instead of a reward, there's some cruel and frowning providence. And that might be enough if you're not really a person of faith. That might be enough to make you call into question either the wisdom of Mordecai or the goodness of God or both. What Esther now sets before us, I mean the book of Esther, is the unfolding of a different and more sinister plot that, at least in its first reading, mistake it and see that it's going to spell the doom of the whole of the Jewish population. Think about the Jews at this time. Particularly those who are in the know, those who are, in fact, apprised of some of the things, at least, which are going on. The Jews who knew, the Jews who had some inkling of what was underway, they certainly rejoiced when they saw the elevation of Esther. Think about the next reaction. Think about what they must have thought when they saw the elevation of Haman. As we see this unfold, it wouldn't be surprising then that these Jews were brought to a point where they have to pause and wonder. Certainly they thought she was the one who would be instrumental in their deliverance, but look, now all of that seems to be in the process of being eclipsed and darkened. What this should remind us of is that we're not to make providence the measure of our faith, nor should we allow the unfolding of providence to drive us off of the promises of God's most holy word. That's not something that Mordecai is going to allow. Our faith has to be formed by the word of God, and from that unassailable tower, then, we're best able to weather the vicissitudes of the mystery of providence. But But look, we also see in this turn of providence the stark line that exists between civil governments as they exist, particularly when they're heathen, and the congregation of the people of God. Now, while at first it might have appeared the command to bow and reverence Haman, that was simply a relatively innocuous command, one that perhaps was intended simply to cultivate a sense of civil decorum, perhaps to engender some respect towards civil officers. But when it's centered on a man such as Haman, an Agagite, the real character of what it is they're demanding in this is exposed to the people of God. And with the Persian state, like so many heathen states and too many nominally Christian states, what they had done was imposed the unconditional authority of the will of the state to enforce an unconditional submission on a population that lived in slavish fear and subjection. That's what they're doing. Now, this impulse arises inevitably. It arises not from the Spirit of God, but rather from the unsanctified demands of the unregenerate heart. And as such, they necessarily make demands that are going to run counter to the Christian priority that places obedience to God over all mindless and passive subjection to the possessors of political power who wield that power without any regard to God or his law. Now, this problem is also exasperated by the fact that every nation has its gods, and in fact all civil powers exert themselves in behalf of some religion, whether they acknowledge that or not. And therefore, when the religion of the state is not the true religion, it is assuring itself that conflict must arise, because the lines have been drawn from the earliest ages between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. Furthermore, those who have the halls of raw power are going to be disposed to avail themselves of that power and its instruments, and they're going to use that power and its instruments to carry out all of its demands regardless of the consequences. They're going to do so without any real thought being given or any concern being expressed for the people of God. It won't matter. Now, this conflict constantly then recalls those who profess the true religion to the question of subjection to civil authorities. Do all powers existing in the province of God have the same claim to the obedience of the people and congregation of God? And if so, are there any exceptions, or is this subjection complete? And if not, what constitutes a legitimate exercise of authority? Now, we leave to the proponents of that wicked doctrine of passive obedience to parse the extremities of stupid subjection to providential powers. Because clearly Mordecai was not poisoned by this perverse notion that leads men to embrace moral turpitude and every kind of existential evil under pain of damnation for rebellion. Mordecai, as has been stated, Mordecai was a covenanter. He was a man in whose breast was the unyielding spirit that moved the martyrs to love the truth as it is in Jesus more than their own lives. Mordecai wasn't one who was stricken with that effeminate and cowardly disposition of those whose minds have been numbed with religion like an opiate. Mordecai was a soldier of the cross, a manly believer who would not only not bow the knee to Baal in secret, he didn't fear to maintain that same posture in open defiance of a most wicked constitution of government. Finally, then, as we see, providence is not our guide if we're Christians. We shouldn't give honor to a government or its agents which has assembled itself against the Lord and his anointed. That's not our place. We have to refuse to honor those who do not honor God, even at the risk of provoking the most powerful and dangerous men of authority within that government. We must declare unequivocally that might does not make right, nor does mere possession bestow genuine authority. Otherwise, the devil himself, being the god of this world, would be the highest authority on earth. Instead, we have to declare that only those whom God honors are entitled to our active and conscientious obedience. And importantly, God honors only them who honor him. This was the principle, then, upon which Mordecai operated, and I would contend it should be ours as well. So, verse 4. Now it came to pass, when they spake daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman, to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. The phrase, "now it came to pass," indicates there was some passage of time. And this doesn't happen all at once, but there is some interval between what Mordecai doesn't do in reverencing or bowing to Haman and it coming to his attention. Now, in the context, it's hard to say exactly how long. But subsequent remarks in one of the following verses implies that it was more like a matter of days rather than a matter of weeks that this transpires. In Esther, this phrase, I think, marks the unfolding of a secret providence as the events which on the surface seem opaque, very dark and mysterious, they unfold with greater and greater consequence, and we begin to see more and more that this is not just a purposeless falling out of events. But as I noted before, the rabbis had commented that the remedy has already been prepared here. Now we see the assault on the people of God unfolding in a series of very small events which are going to snowball into the making of what might be the greatest persecution ever of the Jews. And it's for this very reason that you should resist sin in its beginning, just as you should press into every opportunity. You should impress yourself and press into the smallest acts of obedience. Because as we see from Esther, great evils as well as great goods have arisen from the seemingly smallest acts of either infidelity or fidelity toward the law of God and the true religion. You should never despise the day of small beginnings and something that's good, nor should you ever suffer yourself to take comfort or to become comfortable with the smallest of sins. You shouldn't be saying, "Oh, it's just a small one." Now, when it came to pass, when they spake daily unto him, look at this. The slaves of the empire are not content with asking once, right? They don't just ask him one time, "Why aren't you doing that?" Every time he doesn't do it, they haven't gotten the answer they're looking for, or they haven't gotten the response they've wanted. We're told they ask him literally day by day, day after day. And what this shows us is that what might have begun as a concern for Mordecai over Haman quickly actually becomes a bit of an obsession on their part. Right? They become they're obsessed with what Mordecai is doing. And that's precisely why, as I said before, why friendship with the wicked is such a treacherous thing. Their interest in the actions of the righteous is not rooted in any desire for the glory of God. It really stands in a myriad of self-interests, some of which we just can't fathom. You know, true friends would have warned us against sinful compliances. I'm not going to be like these servants of the king who are trying to induce us to commit sin. The problem is that each of these worldlings may have begun with different degrees and inclinations tending to their own self-interest. But what happens, the more they chatter about this, over time, what they discover is they actually do have a common interest. There's something that will motivate all of them together, and that is they have a common interest against God and true religion. That's why the assembly of wicked men is so often really just the assembly of conspiracy against true righteousness. Because it's the only thing they have in common, is their mutual hatred for God and all things right. And so it is that the minds and the bodies are captive to their king day after day. And over time, as they converse with him, speak with him, they're moved as one man, finally, to make a daily assault against righteous Mordecai. The impression we're getting here is not one day goes by when they're not moved to pester him, probably with questions and comments about his odd and unconventional behavior. Why don't you look like us? It goes from, why didn't you do this, to every other, why aren't you like us? Why don't you behave like us? Why don't you dress like us? Why don't you talk like us? Why don't you go with us when we go here, or go with us when we go there? Think about how often the wicked wonder out loud at the conduct of Christians when it doesn't conform to their notions of civil society. Of course, I guess you can consider how seldom the conduct of Christians actually stand out that way, professed Christians. The problem really is this. Christians can't conform to their notions of civil society because so much of civil society, when you strip it down and look at it, is indistinguishable from the base idolatry of those who live in it. Nonetheless, there is one thing I think that we can observe here. These heathen actually should shame us as Christians. We should admire their persistence in a bad cause. Not that it's a bad cause, but their persistence. We should ask ourselves why we're not more forward in the cause of God and His truth. I think often the pagans have the upper hand in things because they're more diligent in their paganism than we are in our faith in the true God. They openly espouse their unbelief while we quietly retreat into a corner. And often we remain mute in the face of paganism. So we should imitate the heathen in their persistence, not in their paganism, but in their persistence. And it came to pass, when they spake daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them. Though they spoke to him daily, we're told that Mordecai didn't hearken to them. Now, it's not that Mordecai hadn't answered them, by the way. Right? He had, as we're going to see. And he had given them an answer that actually carried with it a lot of significance if they knew anything about it, thought about it. If only they had some understanding, it would be the key to unlocking the answer to all of their questions, undoubtedly. What is interesting in this statement, though, I think, is that right here we're given the first real insight into the character of Mordecai. What this clause tells us is that Mordecai was not swayed by their questions or arguments, their expostulations. He hearkened not means he didn't listen to them. And Mordecai, to the extent they were trying to sway him, he wasn't swayed because he wouldn't even listen to them. He wouldn't give them ear. Right? He took very seriously that admonition of Solomon, "Cease, my son, to hear the instruction that causes the earth and the words of knowledge." He wasn't a great proponent of occasional hearing. And Mordecai just shut his ears to what they were saying. So he wasn't open to their persuasion. He ignored their taunts. And the general indication we get here is that he maintained his course without any deviation. It didn't matter. Their persistence, nothing. Their ability to speak as one man, nothing swayed him. They could stretch out their claims for as long as they wanted, right? They could argue their point to the finest detail. Problem is, it added no weight in his way of thinking. They could appeal to the fact that they're the majority and he is, at least all appearances, he's all alone over there on his own. But none of that's going to move Mordecai. He's not listening to them. Didn't hearken unto them. Now, whether they use enticing words or threatening words, we're not told. It's probably a combination of both from time to time. Now, often men try different approaches to see which one's going to prevail. Sometimes it's a carrot, sometimes it's a stick. Sometimes it's ridicule, sometimes it's argument. Sometimes it's persuasive, sometimes it's threatening. But the more they spoke, the less they seemed to accomplish, simply because he did not hearken unto them. He wouldn't give it the time of day. He didn't entertain their foolishness. He didn't allow himself to get drawn into a conflict, a verbal conflict that would gain him nothing. The only thing he was going to find, if he entertained any of what they said, the only thing that would happen potentially is he himself might start to have doubts. And he just simply had no reason for that. Hearken not unto them. When they speak daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman. That's what they did. They get to the end of their tactics, right? All of the chiding, all of the chattering, all of that, it's getting them nowhere. So they feel like they've exhausted everything they can do, and now they decide they're going to try a different tactic altogether. If Mordecai won't listen to them, maybe he's going to listen to someone else, especially if that someone else is one Haman. Now, with this turn of events, we see very clearly that their interest was not merely an idle curiosity. They're not letting this question go. From their point of view, it demands an answer. And if they're not going to get a response, or if they're not going to get the response they desire from Mordecai, surely they think Haman can do it. So what we see in this unfolding of events is the rising hostility of the wicked toward Mordecai. The workings of the slavish mindset are also, I think, clearly evidenced here. You know, had they really been concerned for Haman's honor, they might have come to him much sooner, but they didn't do that. That wasn't their first course or even their second course. They thought they were going to be able to do all of this on their own and perhaps get a little bit of glory for that. It's only when their attempts to gain a clear account had been rebuffed that they decide that they're going to take the matter to Haman. If they had managed to convince him and convict him of his errors, there would have been no further attempt to press the matter. And if their chiding and chattering had been effective, they might have stopped at that, but Mordecai wasn't moved by them. Now, the word translated told here actually is a little bit different than some words that express people simply speaking. The word told can mean to give evidence in a tribunal or simply to provide an explanation. So while it's clear that they speak of the matter, it actually, from this word, seems a little bit more likely that what these men have done is that they've embellished the account with not only their own interpretations, but maybe even with their own suppositions regarding Mordecai's behavior. Maybe he's doing it because of this. Maybe he's doing it because of that. It implies that they're doing this really as an attempt to get Haman to engage Mordecai directly. And that's actually, I think, something which becomes more clear with the next clause. So after they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matter would stand. We're told now the reason. Why did they bring this to Haman's attention? Well, they want to see how the matter is going to stand. Now, from a somewhat technical point of view, they might have actually been inquiring whether or not Mordecai's actions rose to the height of demanding an official governmental response. It might have been sort of like presenting it to Haman and saying, you know, does this rise to the occasion? Is Mordecai's insubordination to be tolerated? Is there perhaps some other consideration at work, unbeknownst to us, who are just slavish courtiers? Is Mordecai going to be allowed to remain in such open opposition as he has? So they're going to be giving Haman every bit of evidence they can to gain the result which they're seeking. They want a resolution to this, what they view to be a very big problem. And this serves another purpose for them, of course. It gives them the opportunity to present themselves as loyal courtiers. These are now men who are presenting themselves as those who are solidly on the side of Haman and the king. And Mordecai, on the other hand, well, he's being decried as an outsider, a potential enemy within. What we would now call a quisling. From the standpoint of the godless state, these are questions of great importance. Will men bow before their decrees, or do these men have other loyalties? So we're told they want to see whether Mordecai's matter would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. Told them he was a Jew. And presumably what that entailed with respect to the bowing and reverencing in some quasi-religious ceremony to some wicked claimant to power. All of that is probably summed up in he told them he was a Jew. If he said anything as they were trying to speak with him each day, it's very likely that he simply continued to remind them of these facts. I'm a Jew. Now, from this statement, the rabbis have supposed that the latent anti-Semitism of the Persian Empire was bubbling to the surface, and the king's servants are increasingly incensed by reflecting upon this fact. So the hatred was not so much against the Jews as against the true religion. That's really, I think, what's going on here. The thing is, at that time, the true religion is practiced almost entirely by Jews. I'm not sure that they would have been so harsh against the Jews if they'd simply complied with this rule that Ahasuerus had issued regarding bowing and reverencing Haman. So, to the extent that it was against them as Jews, it would have been more of a political calculation, because the Persians had conquered Israel, and maybe they had feared that this represented a reaction to their conquest. So if they are thinking Jew in political terms rather than religious, well, they might have had reason to be concerned, I suppose. Verse 5, "And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not or did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. And when Haman saw..." Once the king's servants had pointed out the case of Mordecai, the indication is that Haman's attention is now fixed. I think what's of great interest here is this. Haman was so puffed up with pride that until the king's servants point this out to him, he didn't notice Mordecai's behavior on his own. When he was walking around in his pomp and circumstance, the indication here is that he didn't so much as deign to look down at anyone to see if they were even compliant or not. He simply assumed they all were. He was so oblivious to his surroundings because he was engrossed in himself. I mean, in point of fact, Haman is worshiping himself in some sense. And that's what pride is. It's self-worship. So look at the pride here of Haman. What has pride done? It's made him like a man struck dumb before his idols, blinded to his environment. He's wandering through life with blinders on. He doesn't even know. All of this has transpired as he walks through the courtyard, and he doesn't notice. As the servants of the king bow and prostrate themselves, Mordecai ignores the command. Day after day, he stands defiant to the order of the king to reverence Haman. Yet, somehow, Haman is so captivated by himself, and perhaps, maybe by the fawning of the courtiers, the slavish servants of the king, whatever it is that has his attention beyond himself, if there is anything, it's captured his attention to the extent that he fails to perceive the failure of Mordecai to comply. Just misses that point entirely. In fact, I think it's kind of interesting. I would assume from the gist of the text that, you know, these servants of the king, they're sort of chiding Mordecai when he's refusing to bow down in reverence Haman. And so it may even be that Haman didn't notice the continual bantering of these servants with Mordecai day after day. You might have missed that too. He perceived himself to be so elevated that he was blissfully unaware that there might be a great rebellion being exposed under his very own nose. He didn't even know what was going on, let alone what it meant. And that's probably the gist of what these servants eventually are implying when they manage to gain his attention. They're trying to say this could be a lot more serious than you might think. When Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not. You know, it's interesting, isn't it, that if Mordecai had just bent himself a little bit toward Haman, all would have gone well for him in the court. There would have been no questions raised whatsoever. If he had just bent himself a little, if he'd just given a little bit, there would have been no controversy if he hadn't entertained this scruple about bowing a little bit to Haman. And yet Mordecai is not like those who compromise their profession and seek to say that we can serve God with the soul even if our bodies are bowed down before idols. See, that's really the difference. Mordecai doesn't have that idea. And this Mordecai actually shares that manly spirit of David in Psalm 26:5, where he says, I have hated the congregation of evildoers and will not sit with the wicked. Mordecai didn't want to identify with them. Mordecai understood, how can the spirit be safe when the body assembles with the congregation of evildoers? How safe are you really when you surround yourself with heathen friends? You know, when you join yourself to a bunch of papists and pagans. Remember, while Mordecai had strictly commanded Esther not to tell her people or kindred, Mordecai now actually, we're told, has revealed his own identity and lineage and he's done it in defense of his defiance, right? So the fact is that when occasion actually required it, Mordecai isn't ashamed to speak of his kindred. And in so doing, he also is making clear he is a member of the true church and professing the true religion. There's no indication of any hesitation here to avow his faith openly before a wicked and watching world. When Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not nor did him reverence. Look at that again. Mordecai doesn't yield any of the expected or commanded reverencing here. Just won't do it. He won't budge on this issue. Now, why is that? I mean, after all, if Mordecai could have given some kind of homage to Haman, knowing he's the king's favorite, if he could have done it without sin, doubtless he would have done so. And after all, why would you place everyone in danger? The problem is, the Persian government was so constituted, and the commands among the Persians were such that he could not pay any respects at all without supposing that there would be some kind of religious worship involved, something of a religious claim or a religious nature. Thus, to bow or reverence, he could only do if he preferred peace to truth, or if he was more concerned about his own life than having a good conscience. Instead, look what Mordecai did. He acts upon that principle that it's not merely desirable. He acts upon the principle it's actually necessary to abstain from all appearance of evil. Not merely desirable, it's necessary. And though he might not attach to this act any overt religious significance, he knew that all Persians would see it as such. If he did this, he already knew how they were going to perceive it. And so he wouldn't set an evil example for weaker brethren who might be led into idolatry. That he knew would be to sin against his brethren and against Christ who gave himself for them. You know, Mordecai wasn't like so many who are so confused today, who say stupid things like they want to put Christ into Christmas, when what he knew or should have known is this is only going to lead weak believers astray, and propose to them terms upon which to make shipwreck of their soul and of their faith. And so when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not nor did him reverence, then we're told was Haman full of wrath. Now I think interestingly, the rabbis at this point say that Haman took the idol from his chest. He took it off and said to Mordecai, bow before me. And Mordecai still wouldn't bow. And then they say that Mordecai remained upright, in fact, to show the others that he was not afraid of Haman. After all of this, Mordecai wouldn't bow, and that made Haman seethe with rage. What exactly transpired, we don't know. But Haman, we're told, was full of wrath. As he contemplated the defiance of Mordecai, his thoughts must have shifted from his bubble to the one man who would not bow. And suddenly, from Haman's point of view, the compliance of all of the rest of the kingdom was of little interest to him at all. Now, in fact, his entire attention is turned to that troublesome Jew, Mordecai. For Haman, then, Mordecai was like that dead fly, which Solomon says spoiled the ointment. From Haman's point of view, how could he take solace in the obedience of all of the rest of the courtiers when this man wouldn't yield obeisance? How bad was it for Haman? Well, the nerve of this man filled him up with wrath, or as rage. The Hebrew word actually denotes venom. Now, if you're reading this story, think for a moment how it might be. If you're reading this story, the end of the result of this venom is not yet clear, right? You read this in Hebrew and you're thinking, oh, he's now filled with venom. And if you don't know the end of the story, you might be saying, well, is this poison? Is this going to, what's going to happen with this venom? Is this going to be the poison that kills Mordecai? Or, as we now know, does this present another twist of providence? Right? I mean, after all, throughout nature, serpents that produce venom are not themselves harmed by that venom. So, if you're just reading this for the first time, you might think this is really going to go bad for Mordecai. Right? But as we're actually going to see in the case of Haman, the venom of man, unlike the venom of a serpent, is actually most deadly to the one who produces it. You know, Solomon in Proverbs 19:11 says, the discretion of a man deferreth his anger, and it is his glory to pass over a transgression. If Haman had only known that. But by nurturing this rage, Haman first destroys his own glory, and then he's going to watch. He's going to watch the entire dissolution and loss of all that he was and all that he had. If Haman had simply overlooked this, as incidentally many other heathen must have done when they had Jews in their court. Think of all the Jews in the court of Pharaoh and Darius and Cyrus and Nebuchadnezzar. All of those kings, they overlooked this. If Haman had simply overlooked it, he would have saved himself from all of the coming misery, and he would have kept all of his honors. However, as one commentator I think has rightly noted here, None are so proud as men who are raised from a dunghill to be seated near the throne. So if we have, if we've had a contrast between the elevation of Esther and that of Haman to consider, I think now we also have a contrast between Mordecai the righteous, as the rabbis call him, and Haman the Agagite, a proud and wicked man. So verse 6. And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. He thought scorn. Now we're moved now from considering the rage of Haman to consider the thinking of Haman. How he's thinking. A man who right now we're led to understand is swollen with venom and really almost paralyzed. He's unable to move beyond the present situation. You know, if all the world bows before him, oh, that's not enough. Yet this one Mordecai not bowing, it's sucking all the pleasure out of his life. And he's going to say that later, by the way. I'm not making that up. He's thinking this way. He thought scorn means that he thought it was below his dignity. He then, as he thought upon Mordecai's defiance, he began to wonder if the dignity of his office might not require him to allow his venomous thinking to expand its quest for a prey. So he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone. And Mordecai alone is the one who had offended him. Mordecai alone is the one who had defied him. Mordecai alone had stood while all the servants of the king bowed and prostrated themselves before Haman. Mordecai alone was the one who had troubled Haman. Mordecai alone was the one who had ignited this poisonous rage within Haman. And normally, in the most disordered of persons, pride desires only the blood of those who've wounded it. Pride doesn't look beyond that. But this is not the case with Haman. He thought scorn. He thought it scorn. It was beneath his dignity, in other words, simply to stop at Mordecai. As his venomous rage fills his soul, his pride is so great, that's the point here, it can't find satisfaction in the blood of Mordecai alone. He thinks he's so important. He thinks it's below the dignity of his position to which he's been elevated only to seek revenge on Mordecai. Now, from his point of view, this grievance calls forth much more. He thought it scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai. Think about that. Now, Haman at first may have only wanted to seek revenge upon Mordecai. And yet, as his thoughts raged with the poison of vengeance, at some point he decides that's actually very far below his personal dignity to go after this one solitary Jew. Should he only reach down to Mordecai, well, that might look like a petty act of a desperate man. Now, there's a reason why it might look like the petty act of a desperate man, because, in fact, that's what it was. However, upon further reflection, There was another line of attack that was brought to Haman's mind. Mordecai had declared to the servants of the king that he was a Jew. What was it to Haman then to cover them with the same criminal charge and to demand the imposition of justice against a rebellious and difficult people? In fact, to elevate the complicity of the whole nation of the Jews would be to raise the whole matter to a more fit thing for the attention of a king, or at least for the attention of the favorite court lackey of the king. So he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews. Now again, I think there's an interesting story that the rabbis tell regarding this. They say that Haman first sought only to kill Mordecai. And their thinking was, at least, they said, according to them, Haman thinks at first, if he just kills Mordecai, he's going to be able to control the congregation of Israel once Mordecai's out of the way. So he contemplates doing that, and then he realizes, wait, beyond Mordecai, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of Torah scholars, rabbis, who would continue to teach the people of God. And so getting rid of Mordecai probably isn't going to be enough. Haman's not going to be able to influence them as long as all of these Torah scholars exist, the scribes and the rabbis and so on. And so Haman then decides, well, these two have to be killed. And finally, when he thinks about it a little bit more, the rabbis say he decides this isn't going to make Israel more tractable. After all, they're a stubborn people. They've never been compliant. They're not going to render a proper obeisance. And so what he hits upon is what we might call the Persian final solution, and that is that all the Jews have to be killed. None of the Jews can be left without imperiling the empire. And that, when he strikes upon that, they say that's a project worthy of the chief office in the king's court. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. You see, having reached this conclusion, he turns his attention to the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. Right? He may not be able to reach every Jew in the world. That probably bothered him a bit, especially when he came to this realization, if the rabbis are right. He may not be able to reach every Jew in the world, but he can certainly reach every Jew in the kingdom. That's actually how interconnected and how efficient the Persian Empire was. And in fact, we're going to see that when they start sending out all these communications. Now, what this shows us is the breadth as well as the depth of the rage of Haman. Think about this. Here's a man who's willing to sacrifice an entire nation in order to satisfy his lust for revenge. Now, I will say this. It was not uncommon among the heathen, if they punished a man for some crime, to take his entire family out and to punish them as well. And we see that in the case of Achan in the Bible. There was some thought that there might be some complicity in all of this. But Haman actually pushes this feature of heathen tyranny to its limit. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. So we're reminded here at the very end of this verse, it's not the people or the congregation of Israel who've actually sinned against the monarch or his favorite. It's actually one man, Mordecai. And yet such is the unreasonableness of wrath, especially when it's combined with this kind of despotism, that it cannot hear the voice of justice. It cries only for the blood without any thought of reason or justice. So first of all, I think you should consider here the faith of Mordecai in contrast to the chattering challenges of the wicked slaves of the heathen state. Who is Mordecai and what has he done? Well, he's shown a wise concession when he found himself seated in the gate of the king. He had demonstrated a desire to seek God's best in the kingdom and to set a godly example before those who were with him. Very likely didn't see in accepting this position that there might come an assault upon his faith. Mordecai tried to live a quiet and peaceable life under a king who could hardly be commended to the conscientious obedience of those who were faithful to the true religion. So this concession stopped when he was required to make a confession of his faith. When silence could be construed as an acquiescence or worse, an active participation, Mordecai shows us that we must not hesitate to call upon the name of the Lord. We must not hesitate to say that we're on the Lord's side. It's not enough in those situations that we allow misunderstandings to remain when we can clear them up. Like Mordecai, we are required to declare our lineage and people. We have to declare our faith. But consider it second. Mordecai is not only faithful when he's called to confess his faith. He does so not in a reticent way. He doesn't draw back from it. He does so with an earnestness and a steadfastness that I suspect actually shocked his enemies. And that may be why they react so poorly in the end and feel the need to get Haman involved. I think he also shocks his enemies because his enemies are actually all those who are patrons of passive submission to unlawful authorities. But as the prospect of danger arose, you know, it would have been very easy for his faith to waver or for his confession to falter in some way. He could have found a place to trim or tuck a little bit and maybe avoid persecution. Instead, Mordecai remained firm and unshakable. Mordecai demonstrated the perfection of his love for God because he had no fear of what any man might do to him. In fact, Mordecai didn't even care that he was in the minority. Mordecai actually believed and counted things a little differently. He thought he was in the right, and that right made him actually the genuine majority. Third, remember, Mordecai, he knew the times and the seasons. Mordecai knew that Israel must be delivered. He knew all of this going in. And so he knew that there are limits to the threats of men. He knew that they could go no further than God would allow. He also knew that none can overthrow the purpose of God, and so none could overthrow Israel, because he understood that Israel still figured very large in the purposes of God. And all of this instills in Mordecai an undaunted courage to face whatever may come, because he knew that the weapons which were formed against the church of God in his day would never prevail. He knew that in standing alone, he was not alone. He knew that in facing the anger of the king, he was facing the smiles of a benevolent providence. He could challenge the wrath of the favorite of the heathen king's court precisely because God's favorites, like Mordecai, are those who know that to live is Christ and to die is gain. He could place all in peril for himself, for Esther, and even for the congregation of Israel, because he knew that his cause was secure with God in the midst of persecution, as much as it would have been secure had it remained in some quiet corner, abiding in peace. Consider fourthly, such is the rage of the wicked that it will stop at nothing to destroy the cause of God and truth. Haman's rage is not the rage of a man. Haman's rage is actually the rage of the devil, seeking to devour in one swift movement the entire church of God. And how did Haman find himself there? You see, Haman, through pride, fell into the temptation of the devil. And he's going to garner the reward of the wicked as that long conflict between the seed of the serpent continues against the seed of the woman. Finally, I think it's interesting. The voice of Haman cried against the people of God for blood. Every year, the Jews celebrated this, the festival of Purim. But the lesson that the Jews should have learned from this event is going to be lost on their descendants. Because if you remember, at a later time and under a different empire, there's going to be the voice of vengeance crying out for blood. And in that day, the ruler of the empire is actually going to try to wash his hands of any part in carrying out that vengeance. However, with cries of his blood be upon us and our children, the Jews are going to consign their Messiah to the torturous death of the Roman cross without reason or without justice. Now, as Christians, we shouldn't embrace the heathenish principles that prevailed in the crucifixion of our Lord. We have to acknowledge the unjustness and wickedness of the hands by which he was crucified, while confessing at the same time that he died not for sins that he had done, but because of our iniquities which were laid upon him. He died not unjust, but the just for the unjust. Let us then cast our anchor of faith upon him and not stumble at the promises as the Jews, for whom we must pray that God take away the veil that's over their heart even to this day, that they can't see what they've done when they cried out for the blood of one without justice or reason. Amen.